So Ryan is going to come up here and talk a little bit about how we turn that around, right? So every time, I'm looking forward to this, because every time I get a request from the government to give somebody else documents, it makes me happy to know that somebody else is going to be fucking with the government the other way around, right? So Ryan is up at MIT right now. He is not only a first-time speaker, but this is his first time at DEF CON. So let's give a big party track welcome to Ryan Shapiro, who's going to talk about hacking the FBI.
Thank you, sir.
Good luck.
Thanks.
Thank you all so much for being here. This is my first time at DEF CON. I understand that means someone might fuck with me, so bring it on. But so my name is Ryan Shapiro, a little about myself. I'm a longtime animal rights activist, social justice activist, transparency activist, and now also a PhD candidate at MIT, where I am an historian of the political functioning of national security. This is a talk about information and democracy, about oppression and resistance, and about the tools that make resistance possible. But first, we're gonna start with a little bit of a stroll down memory lane. My own, that is. And so I've always liked animals, even as a little kid, nothing political about it. Here I am as a little kid with a goat. Around the time I was 12, I got into radical politics, especially through punk rock. Here I am in eighth grade. This is like 88 or something. And around that same time, I started thinking about animals in more political terms. And I decided to go vegetarian. And really, for me, it was about justice. I have a healthy self-esteem, but the idea that another living being should lose his or her entire life merely to satisfy 20 or 30 minutes of my whim seemed unjust to me, and so I stopped eating animals. I didn't know anything about it, how animals are treated. I just stopped. A few years later, I moved to New York to go to NYU, and around that same time, I also started learning much more about how animals are actually treated on factory farms, routinely confined in cages so small they can't stand up, turn around, spread their limbs. 9 billion animals every year in the US, 63 billion globally. And around that same time, I went vegan based on what I was learning. And I also started deciding that I could no longer simply not participate in the process. It wasn't enough to simply not pay people to torture and kill animals for me, but I needed to do something about it. And so I co-founded activist campaigns, very aggressive activist campaigns, got arrested really constantly all the time. This is my first arrest. I'm in the red vans. We have welded steel rebar into steel pipes where we've locked our arms. We're blocking the entrance to the circus so the elephants can't get in, shutting down Ringling Circus. It worked and shut down the circus. They were able to get the elephants to the top of the ramp, though, and held them there until they urinated, so we marinated in elephant piss for a few hours. So we're very popular when we finally got to jail after they cut us out. But nonetheless, I did a lot of this sort of work. Taking over the president of NYU's office to shut down a laboratory where they were forcing chimpanzees to smoke crack. Here I am, after having locked my neck to a first door, basically the same thing, but inside a mall. I think the camo pants and tie is a very distinguished look, by the way. And then when the New York police got too good at cutting through these steel pipes that we had locked our arms in, and they got very good at it, we took oil drums and put the steel pipes into the oil drums and then filled those oil drums with concrete. And so now the cops would have to jackhammer through the concrete and then cut through. And then when they got too good at that, we put tar on the concrete, steel fire doors. We've got all that going on here. I got far better at the science of concrete than I ever expected to. You can see it's extremely disruptive when they're trying to cut it out. So these were, at least tactically, very successful techniques. I moved to Hawaii and shut down a captive dolphin facility in a shopping mall and got cetacean, along with a few other activists, got cetacean captivity banned on all of Maui County, which is several islands. Did a bunch of whale hunt sabotaging, which is I was riding the jet skis in between the gunboats and the whales in order to prevent the whalers from killing the whales. It's me on the boat. And then, so this is 2000, 2001 now. At that time, I moved back from Hawaii to the East Coast, start getting a master's degree in modern American history. And also at that time, I began co-coordinating a year-long undercover investigation of foie gras factory farms. So these are duck factory farms. And the conditions there are the same as factory farms for any other animal. Animals confined in cages so small they can't stand up, turn around, spread their limbs. And this investigation was tremendously successful. And we also openly rescued a number of animals, or liberated or stole, what have you, from these farms. The investigation was very successful. We made a documentary about it. It sparked national and international campaigns, got the sale and production of foie gras banned in the state of California, one of only two states that produce foie gras. And we weren't the first people to do this sort of work. It's not even the first time that we had done this work, but it was the first time that someone was prosecuted for doing it. And so Sarah Jane Blum, this activist on the cover of the documentary here, and I, we were prosecuted. We were charged with felony burglary in the state of New York, 7-year maximum. We didn't expect to get 7 years, but we had lengthy rap sheet in New York, and I don't know if we were lucky, 6 months, if we were unlucky, 2 years, you know. But it seemed like a fair trade for us. Obviously, that would suck going to prison, right? But it seemed like a fair trade for the sort of work that we're doing. We were really happy with the campaign, and I really just wanted to get my master's done before going to prison, because you know, it's hard to finish a master's from prison. I've helped friends. It's rough. But it's a tremendous surprise. We beat the charges against us. We got 40 hours of community service for a group of our choice, which was an animal rights group, so we just got credit for doing what we'd already done. But this left me in a difficult situation. So this is 2004 now, and right about the same time when we beat these charges, there's a tremendous legislative, legal, and prosecutorial shift in the United States. In 2004, the FBI designated the animal rights and environmental movements the leading domestic terror threat in the United States. Leading domestic terror threat. And this isn't just rhetoric. This is about resource allocation. Keep in mind that neither the animal rights nor the environmental movement have ever once physically injured a single person in this country ever, and yet designated the leading domestic terror threats in the United States. Shortly thereafter, there was the passage of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, or AETA, which is a pernicious piece of post-9/11 legislation that explicitly targets animal rights and environmental activists as terrorists. What's that? That is exactly right. The Animal Liberation Front has never physically injured a single person in this country ever, or any other country for that matter. But let's hold questions to the end. But yes, that's absolutely right. Neither the animal rights nor the environmental movement have ever physically injured a single person in this country ever. You can find industry groups making arguments to the contrary, but those arguments are simply wrong. They're just simply wrong. Nonetheless, then the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which explicitly targets animal rights and environmental activists as terrorist threats. People have been prosecuted. The very first prosecution under the AETA was a prosecution of animal rights activists in California who wrote anti-animal experimentation slogans on the sidewalk in chalk. And they were prosecuted as terrorists, felony terrorism charges under federal law. Mercifully, the judge threw out the charges, but the FBI investigated. The DOJ brought it. And around the same time, many of my closest friends and colleagues, including many of the people you've seen in these pictures, began going to jail, going to prison, federal prison, under this law and under its predecessor act, the Animal Enterprise Protection Act. These people, who are among my closest friends, are known as the Shack 7, and they were sentenced from between 1 to 7 years in federal prison for violation of the Animal Enterprise Protection Act for running a website, an anti-animal experimentation website. That's exactly what happened. And so, I didn't know what to do next. And all of this is what journalist Will Potter has termed the green scare, the disproportionate use of the rhetoric and apparatus of national security to target animal rights and environmental activists. So green scare, like the red scare. And if you're interested in more on this, I'd encourage you to check out Will Potter's great book, Green is the New Red, or his blog of the same name, Green is the New Red. He also reports a lot on my work. So I really didn't know what to do next, right? I'd finished my master's degree, I wasn't going to do that. And then the entire model of activism that I'd pursued for the previous decade with relative impunity was all of a sudden just completely untenable. It's one thing to go to prison for 6 months or even a year for rescuing many animals and starting international campaigns, but to go to prison to go to federal prison as a terrorist on felony charges for writing on the sidewalk in chalk, it's just not a reasonable exchange. So I didn't know what to do next, and like lots of people who don't know what to do next, I stayed in grad school. I started a PhD at MIT. As I said, I'm an historian of the political functioning of national security. I'm finishing up that PhD now. My P- PhD is looking at the long history of these sorts of trends. So the long history of the use of the rhetoric and apparatus of national security to marginalize animal protectionists as threats to the state. And there is a long history, and I'll talk just a very little about that now. For example, in World War I, when American anti-vivisectionists, so people who opposed animal experimentation, and this is one of their newsletters from World War I, when they opposed wartime animal experimentation, the research defense community, or the pro-animal experimentation folks, led by this guy, who's a famous neurosurgeon. Hi.
Hi. So, we have a tradition here at DEF CON for first-time speakers. It is a way for us to welcome them into the community, and I hope you guys are all thoroughly enjoying his talk so far. He asked for us to do this at the end of his talk, but we don't follow those rules. So,
all right.
Salute.
Sir.
Party track!
All right. Thanks. Carry on.
Thank you very much. That's the best hazing I've ever had. So yeah, this guy, who is a famous neurosurgeon, friends with the president. Either way, he wrote an article in prestigious science magazine in which he essentially argued, quote, that anyone attempting to stump the Red Cross from assisting in its humanitarian and humane desire to prevent American soldiers from being diseased is in reality giving aid and comfort to the enemy. The folks on his side went so far as to call for charges to be brought under the new Wartime Espionage Act of 1917 for opposing wartime animal experimentation. Fortunately, charges weren't brought, but these allegations of subversion, that they were taking their orders from the Kaiser, were devastating to the animal protection movement at that time. Moving forward, World War II, the descendants of that of the previous gentleman, whose name was Keane, this guy's name is Ivy. Ivy was a famous, he was basically a rock star animal experimenter and vice president at the University of Chicago. Either way, Ivy was also the expert witness on medical ethics at the prosecution of Nazi doctors in Nuremberg. He was also at the same time the lead of the American pro-animal experimentation community, a group called the National Society for Medical Research. When he came back from Nuremberg and the press wanted to hear what he had to say about the trial, he said, hey, you know what I learned over there? I learned that the Nazis banned animal experimentation in 1933, and this is why they had to experiment on human beings in the concentration camp. Completely false, absolutely false. He knew it was false. I just finished writing 100 pages on it. So I can speak at length. I'm not going to right now. But either way, he knew he was lying, but the press ate it up. And he further went on to say that the only reason American anti-vivisectionists opposed animal experimentation was because they wanted to open Nazi-styled human experimentation concentration camps in the United States. Then, within a couple years, with World War III more in American minds than World War II, the NSMR and Ivy, they upped their game. And they argued that because some animal experiments involved radiation, that American opposition to animal experimentation was a Kremlin-directed plot meant to undermine American security in order to pave the way for Soviet atomic aggression and overthrow of the United States government. As NSMR argued to the press, and again, these are really famous people. These aren't, you know, a random lobby group. These are tremendously prestigious academics. Time magazine called Ivy the conscience of American science. NSMR argued that, quote, the fanatics who oppose animal experimentation for sentimental reasons are being joined and in some parts led by communists and communist sympathizers interested in sabotaging national defense. National defense project aims at minimizing death from possible attacks with atomic bombs are being crippled by anti-vivisectionists and that, quote, foreign agents rejoice at every victory scored by anti-vivisectionists. Even the Los Angeles Times concurred, declaring it was, quote, beyond dispute that animal experimentation is necessary to the national defense and opposition to it placed directly into the hands of the Russian communists and their schemes to overthrow the United States. This is the sort of press that they routinely got. And, I mean, these campaigns were tremendously successful. Pittman Moore Pharmaceuticals sponsored this ad, which went even further and said that if good comes from the atomic bomb, we need to thank animals and, more importantly, animal experimentation. And again, these campaigns were devastating. This use of the rhetoric and apparatus of national security to marginalize animal protectionists as threats to the state, absolutely devastating. And there were, by the way, real radiation experiments on animals, but they didn't look like this. They looked like this. This is a live pig and an atomic blast experiment. But we're going to move forward now back from the actual Red Scare period to the Green Scare again. So for the work that I've just gone through, my source base was primarily archival, but it's not like the FBI is going to hand over their documents very kindly to archives around the country so that researchers can go and look and see what's up. And I want to know what's up, right? I want to be able to answer the questions, not just from before the 1970s, but I want to understand I want to understand how the animal rights movement first came to the attention of the FBI, how the FBI's understanding of the animal rights movement evolved over time, how they understand the movement as whole and component parts, how they develop infiltrators, and most importantly, how they came to designate the movement the leading domestic terror threat in the country without ever physically injuring a single person ever. And since there was no archival source space, I turned to the only thing that I could think of in order to do this dissertation work, which was the Freedom of Information Act. And I knew very little about FOIA at that time. I knew it existed, and so I submitted a request just to see what would happen. I submitted a request on myself to the FBI, and I got this letter back, which said they didn't have anything. And in addition to being a little surprised, I'll admit to being a little hurt, really. And, but all right, that's fine, a little humiliated, that's fine. So I then submitted a request on Sarah Jane Blum, who you saw, who had also been prosecuted with me, and as opposed to me when I had been arrested that last time for that duck liberation, which was just cops when they came to arrest me. When they came to arrest her, there was an FBI agent involved, so I was very confident that they'd have documents on her. And again, they sent back a letter saying they had nothing, and I was like, wow, that's really strange. And so I submitted another request this time. I was like, all right, I got this now. I submitted a request on a friend of mine, and I knew they would have documents on her. The FBI raided their house. They must have some information on this person. And again, the letter came back, nothing. And so I was like, oh, I get it. I'm being lied to, right? And keep in mind, I mean, I've been involved with, as I said, radical politics since I was 12, so the idea that the FBI is fucked up is not something new to me. However, I guess naively assumed that the FBI's FOIA division might be less mission-driven than its investigative wing. And I realized very quickly, though, that I was wrong. But then it raised this question. The question was how? How was the FBI systematically avoiding compliance with the Freedom of Information Act? How is the leading federal law enforcement agency in the country succeeding in consistently and flagrantly violating federal law, the Freedom of Information Act? And so I became obsessed with mapping out not only the nature and evolution of the FBI's campaigns against the animal rights movement, but also mapping out the precise mechanisms of the FBI's noncompliance with the Freedom of Information Act. And we all have traits that at any given time may prove to be advantageous or detrimental. In this case, my OCD and need for conflict proved to be pretty beneficial. So I just became absolutely obsessed with this, and I started submitting hundreds of FOIA requests, with each request designed not only to produce the requested records about FBI and animal rights matters, but also to determine the precise mechanisms of FBI FOIA noncompliance. So I submit a request. It comes out in the end there and they got nothing. What happens in that black box? How do they get away with it? Part of the problem is historical. In 1974, when Congress amended the Freedom of Information Act to actually target the intelligence agencies, in no small part because of Watergate and COINTELPRO and MKUltra and all the revelations that were coming out at that moment, the intelligence agencies freaked out and they tried to destroy FOIA, and when they failed, they tried to statutorily exempt themselves from it. Some of the agencies had better luck with that than others, and the FBI only had mediocre luck, and so they had to come up with who knows how many dirty tricks in order to avoid compliance with FOIA. And I was seeking to figure out what those tricks were, but it was very difficult to do that because the information was secret and the primary tool we would have to do it was to use FOIA. So it was something of a challenge. So I began submitting hundreds of requests. I analyzed and compared hundreds of their responses. I thought of it as a process akin to trying to map out the bottom of the ocean as a submarine using sonar pings. So even if I got nothing back, document-wise, the manner in which they denied the request was very useful. And over a period of years, just obsessing over this data, a picture began to coalesce. And so I also started submitting FOIA requests about the processing of my FOIA requests, so FOIA requests about how they actually failed to comply with the previous request. That's a very successful strategy, and now, as a result, they have a policy where they refuse to comply with FOIA requests about FOIA requests, and so I have a lawsuit against the FBI right now challenging their policy about not complying with FOIA requests about FOIA requests. I also scoured the case law for information about FBI FOIA operations. I scoured FBI litigation declarations for information on FBI FOIA operations. As I said, an obsessive amount of work over a period of years. And in the process, two things became very apparent. One, The FBI does nearly everything in its power to avoid compliance with the Freedom of Information Act. Indeed, if FOIA work with some agencies is akin to trying to get customer service from a giant telecom over a holiday weekend, it's gonna suck, it's gonna take a long time, you're gonna be frustrated and hate it, but in the end you might get something and it'll be all right. FOIA work with the FBI is a street fight. They will do everything they can to avoid compliance. It would be difficult to overstate the bad faith with which the FBI is operating when it comes to matters of the Freedom of Information Act. And two, essential to making the Freedom of Information Act work with the FBI was developing an intimate familiarity with the Bureau's FOIA-specific information storage and retrieval systems. And using the above techniques and others, I did just that. All of which allowed me to pursue an iterative approach to FOIA requests where I would figure out the various roadblocks that they were using to prevent me from getting the records that I wanted. I would finally get something, any record, and then once I got that, one could comb those records to find specifics to get around other roadblocks. And this iterative approach was just tremendously useful. It was also helpful that I got signed privacy waivers from roughly 300 leading animal rights and environmental activists from the 1970s to the present, allowing me to request their records. It doesn't mean that the FBI would give them to me, but it means I have a lot more flexibility in what I do on my end. And this really began to pay off. Combined these and other experimental FOIA methodologies that I developed proved stunningly successful. And I received over 40,000 pages from the FBI on their campaigns against the animal rights and environmental movements. Among the most notable of these documents was a document I obtained which demonstrated FBI consideration of Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act charges against undercover investigators who expose factory farming cruelty. That's this document here. And despite all the redactions, it's nonetheless extremely telling. The FBI is arguing, not even arguing, what we see here that the FBI is doing is trying to bring federal terrorism charges against people who take pictures of animals trapped in cages. Terrorism charges against those individuals who take those pictures. And I'll note I was especially displeased to see my name on this document. This document also is currently being used as evidence in Blum versus Holder, which is a federal lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act. This is Blum v. Holder. I'm one of the five plaintiffs in this lawsuit. We're represented by the New York City-based Center for Constitutional Rights. And we actually just asked the Supreme Court to review the case just this very week. Right, so it's working, yeah? I figured out all the ways the FBI was avoiding compliance. I beat those ways, and then the FBI said, oh, you're very clever, look at you, look what you can do, watch what we can do. They sat on their fucking hands, they did nothing because they can. FOIA is entirely toothless, and it's one of the giant problems with the Freedom of Information Act. Though the Freedom of Information Act only allows an agency 20 working days to comply with a request, there are no penalties for non-compliance. So the FBI just sat on my request. Not 20 days, not months, years, some of them. And so I sued the FBI for failure to comply with the Freedom of Information Act. There's no penalties for non-compliance, but you can sue if they're in violation of the law. And so I did. I sued them, and it is my first lawsuit against the FBI. It covers about 80 of my animal rights-related Freedom of Information Act requests, and what was supposed to happen here is that the judge did. She said, essentially, FBI, obviously, you're in violation of the law. It's way past 20 days. It's years in some cases. When are you going to get to this? Not when will you give them the documents, but when will you, do the work, decide whether or not you're going to give the documents, give reasons why you're not going to give them. And instead, the FBI responded by invoking what's considered the nuclear option in a FOIA case, which is called an Open America Stay, which is kind of just an extreme delay, which is essentially a total exemption from FOIA for a specified period of time. And in my case, the FBI is asking for an almost unheard of 7-year Open America Stay. So they want 7 years to do nothing, to think about what to do about my FOIA requests. And what's particularly outrageous about this, I consider that deeply outrageous as it is, but what's particularly outrageous about this is that the core element of the FBI's motion for an Open America Stay is a radically updated version of a Cold War era FOIA secrecy doctrine known as mosaic theory. Mosaic theory is somewhat plausible on its face. Any individual bit of information by itself may be innocuous, but once you combine it with other information, who knows what the Soviets will be able to do with it, right? And so a classic example would be someone submits a FOIA request to the FBI for all unpaid parking tickets from FBI agents, and the FBI says, well, we can't give those to you because once you have those, you know, who knows what the Soviets could learn from our unpaid parking tickets, right? And again, it's sort of plausible on its face a little bit, but not really. No information is understood in a vacuum. All information is understood mosaically. But nonetheless, and mosaic theory had actually been in disuse by the time that my case came around. But not only did the FBI bring it back, is bringing it back, but they are doing so in a radically updated version. Old mosaic theory is specific to the document. It's at the document level. We cannot give you this document because we don't know what you're going to combine it with. In this case, the FBI is arguing not at the document level, but at the universe of knowledge level. We can't decide whether or not to give you these records that you've requested, which is about 350,000 pages in this lawsuit. We can't decide whether or not to give you these pages because of the universe of knowledge that exists outside of them. So we need to think about each of these pages in relation to every other document that exists in the public record about the FBI, that the FBI has about the animal rights movement, that someone else might request about the animal rights movement. So it's not we can't give you document X because mosaic, it's we can't process these requests because we have to think about the entire universe of knowledge before we do. And by the way, that universe of knowledge is always updating, so it's gonna take us a while. It is a flatly outrageous move. And worse, at the core of all of this is a supposed national security risk. The FBI is arguing, in order to make this preposterous claim, the FBI is arguing that my dissertation FOIA research methodologies constitute a threat to national security. And which I said, thank you, that's gonna look great on the back of the book. But keep in mind here that the FBI is not arguing that the release of documents, again about 350,000 pages in this case, would be a threat to national security, but rather the FBI is arguing that deciding whether or not to release the documents before 7 years would be a threat to national security. Further, the purported risk to national security posed by my dissertation research, according to the FBI, is ostensibly so grave that the FBI can't even tell us what that risk is. The FBI's primary support for its argument to support these doubly preposterous contentions is submitted to the court in the form of an ex parte in-camera declaration, which is essentially a secret letter from the terrorism division of the FBI to the judge about why my dissertation FOIA research about the animal rights movement is such a threat to national security. And it's important to note here that though the FBI, of course, doesn't want damning information coming out about their campaigns against the animal rights movement, it'll be embarrassing for them. That's not really what this is about at all. Their core motivation here is preserving their functional immunity from the Freedom of Information Act. The FBI has viewed political dissent as a security threat since its earliest days. Since J. Edgar Hoover coordinated the Palmer raids right after World War I, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI has viewed political dissent as a security threat. And ever since the Freedom of Information Act was amended in 1974 to target the FBI, the FBI has understood the Freedom of Information Act in the very same light. And that's what we have here, an attempted broad-scale end run around FOIA by the FBI. Indeed, the FBI's strategy here is so radical that if the judge accepts it, it could be used to shut down almost anyone's FOIA request. And that's why a host of open government groups, the National Lawyers Guild, Center for Constitutional Rights, National Security Archive, have joined as amici in opposing the FBI's efforts to shut down my dissertation FOIA research. But the FBI is not alone, and what they were really trying to do here is not only, of course they're trying to do an end run around FOIA, they're trying to make sure that Essentially, FOIA has never really worked with the FBI for broad-scale research. Every once in a while, someone submits a request. Maybe they'll get something, and they're so thrilled that they got something, they'll think it's a victory, but it's not. For broad-scale research, if you know what you want, you're trying to get a lot of documents, and you want to get it, and the law says you should be able to get it, FOIA has not worked with the FBI on this level. Other agencies, yes, not the FBI. And so the FBI is trying to preserve its functional immunity from the Freedom of Information Act from everyone and from me, but this issue remains on the judge's desk. It's actually been on her desk for 2 years now, whether or not they get this Open America stay on mosaic theory grounds. We're waiting for a ruling from her now. But this, rather than shutting down my work, I've just dramatically expanded it. I can't do much work on the animal rights movement right now because it's all tied up in this lawsuit. And so I now have a series of non-animal rights related FOIA projects against the FBI and other agencies. I now have over 800 FOIA requests in motion with the FBI, which likely makes me the person with the most ever. I now have 7 lawsuits against the FBI and other agencies for their failure to comply with the Freedom of Information Act, covering hundreds of my requests. And again, the FBI is not alone here in their absolute allergy to transparency. The United States intelligence apparatus more broadly shares this same allergy. And I am targeting this in a series of my other projects. So for example, I have a FOIA project dealing with Nelson Mandela. So I have FOIA requests to the FBI, the CIA, the DIA, and the NSA on records on Nelson Mandela. I want to know what role the CIA had in Mandela's 1962 arrest leading to his decades of incarceration for his struggle for racial justice and democracy in South Africa. It's very likely the CIA was intimately involved in that process. I also want to know why Nelson Mandela remained on the US terror watch list until 2008, long after he received the Nobel Prize, a prize from the president, a prize from Congress, and yet on the US terror watch list until 2008. All 4 of these agencies denied my FOIA requests, the FBI, CIA, DIA, and NSA. But the most notable denial was from the NSA. And the NSA refuses to even confirm or deny the existence of records on Mandela because the mere fact, according to the NSA, of the existence or non-existence of records on Mandela is itself classified in the interest of national security. Further, the NSA also invoked, again, the Espionage Act of 1917 to justify their denial of my request. I am making quite good headway in court. I mean, I'm suing all of these agencies right now for these violations of FOIA, represented by my excellent FOIA attorney, Specialist Jeffrey Light, based out of D.C., But I am making excellent progress right now on the FBI in court, and I've already received a good number of documents from the FBI on Nelson Mandela. And these documents, like this one, reveal that while the FBI was supposed to be protecting Mandela in 1990 after he got out of prison, after 30 years likely, because the CIA helped put him there, the FBI, instead of protecting him, or in addition to protecting him, was cultivating confidential informants within Mandela's inner circle in order to spy on Mandela and provide political information on Mandela to the FBI. Further documents I've received from the FBI as victories in my lawsuit against them here demonstrate that the FBI understood the anti-apartheid movement, not just Mandela, but the anti-apartheid movement on the whole, essentially as a Soviet-inspired communist threat to American national security, just as they understood Martin Luther King to be. And the FBI kept this understanding of Nelson Mandela and the anti-apartheid movement as threats to American security even after the fall of the Berlin Wall. So even as the Cold War crumbled into obsolescence, the FBI remained obsessed with Nelson Mandela and the anti-apartheid movement being a Soviet threat to the United States. I also have a FOIA request and lawsuit against the FBI for their failure to comply with those requests for records on a sniper plot against Occupy Houston. It turns out that probably some militia group was planning to assassinate Occupy leaders in Houston, and the FBI was far more interested in monitoring the activities of the occupiers rather than the terrorists who were actually plotting to murder the occupiers. In court right now, the FBI is arguing that they shouldn't have to give me these records because Occupy was a bunch of terrorists and they were a national security threat. Fortunately, the judge had a very good ruling here and said that the FBI can't simply invoke these words talismanically, national security or terrorism. They actually have to back it up. I think they failed to do that entirely, and we're waiting on the judge to decide what she thinks right now. I also have an ongoing lawsuit against the FBI for their failure to comply with my Freedom of Information Act on Aaron Swartz. I also have an ongoing FOIA request and lawsuit against the FBI, as I mentioned earlier, for their failure to comply with my FOIA requests about my FOIA requests. And then there's a bunch more coming in the pipeline, too. But all of this brings us back to the Freedom of Information Act is one of the most underappreciated elements of the entire American experiment. The notion that the records of government are the property of the people and all we need to do to get them is to ask for them is radically democratic. But FOIA is broken. And this is just one element of the ongoing crisis of secrecy we now face. Harvard historian of science, Peter Galison, has demonstrated that the universe of classified knowledge now exponentially exceeds the universe of published unclassified knowledge, and that this disparity grows by the day. So there is literally exponentially more classified information in the world right now than there is published unclassified information. And classification is just one part of the problem. It's far from the whole of it. Most of the records that I'm seeking from the FBI, such as the 350,000 pages at issue in my Open America animal rights lawsuit with the FBI, they're not classified. The FBI just refuses to give them up. In fact, the FBI and DOJ on the whole invoke classification only about 5% of the time when they're denying FOIA requests. The other 95% of the time, they're just saying, fuck you, no. I mean, they're using one of the other exemptions, but it's not classification. These aren't classified documents. They're just saying no. Secrecy is a cancer on the body of democracy. It is a cancer on the body of democracy, and despite entering office promising to be the most transparent administration ever, the Obama administration has outdone even Bush on this front. The Obama administration has brought more Espionage Act prosecutions of whistleblowers than all previous administrations combined. And as the Associated Press recently reported, the Obama administration has invoked national security to deny FOIA requests more than ever before. The records of government are the property of the people. But as we have seen, these records are consistently withheld from us on the basis of undefined national security concerns. Yet, what do we mean by national security? We need to start asking who we are as a nation and what it means for us to be secure. In the United States since 9/11, depending on how you define the term, roughly a few dozen people have been killed by terrorism. And not including 9/11, since 1970, the number of people killed by terrorism in the United States is about 500. Here's a question for you. According to the Centers for Disease Control, about how many Americans die every year falling out of bed? Any guesses? It's not thousands, but it's a lot. It's 400 up. It's up there, right? Which is still pretty remarkable. Most importantly, that means almost as many people die every year in the United States falling out of beds than have died from terrorism in the United States, excluding 9/11, since 1970. And yet, we don't install surveillance cameras in people's bedrooms. We don't monitor those going in and out of mattress stores. And we don't put heavy sleepers on watch lists. So why are we so willing to sacrifice our most cherished liberties over a vastly smaller threat? Again, what do we mean by national security? As wrote Judge Murray Gerfein in his ruling against the Nixon administration's infamous attempt to prevent the New York Times from publishing the leaked Pentagon Papers, quote, "The security of the nation is not at the ramparts alone. Security also lies in the values of our free institutions." Building upon this ruling, we as a nation need to foster a broader understanding of national security. We need to embrace an understanding in which the security of our nation is best maintained not by secrecy and surveillance and drone strikes, but rather by the free exchange of ideas among an informed citizenry. Such a citizenry is impossible, however, without broad public access to information about the operations of government. In the interest of promoting such a citizenry, all available tools need to be used. I've used FOIA to hack the FBI, but FOIA is broken, and even at its best, FOIA can only go so far. Other forms of information access are now necessary. This can in part be done in the form of heroic whistleblowers and leakers like Snowden and Manning and Ellsberg. However, when FOIA is broken, and when there are sadly not enough whistleblowers to be found, another form of hacking is required to return the records of government to their rightful owners, breaking in and taking those records. And there's a historical precedent here. In 1971, a group calling itself the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI broke into an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and liberated the records that informed the world of the FBI's notorious COINTELPRO, or counterintelligence program. This is how we learned of the FBI's illegal and unconstitutional surveillance, suppression, and likely at times murder of anti-war activists, civil rights activists, free speech activists. This is how we learned of J. Edgar Hoover's obsession with Martin Luther King Jr., including his quest to have King kill himself. Because Hoover believed King to be a communist threat. And it's because brave individuals broke into this FBI office and stole those records that we knew about this. People then began submitting FOIA requests. Congress began investigating, but none of it could happen without the initial information on which to go. But for better or worse, this sort of break-in is no longer especially viable. Indeed, there is now a need for heroes to straight hack the FBI and other intelligence agencies to liberate the records of government. And I want to be clear, there are very serious consequences. The most serious consequences. I'm calling for violation of the Espionage Act here. So anyone who is even moderately interested in what I'm saying, please take the time to think about what we're talking about here, what I'm talking about here today. Because again, these are deeply serious issues that we're discussing. Any administration will be deeply antagonistic to it, and the present administration is among the most radical in that regard. But in the absence of an adequately workable FOIA or whistleblowers, I argue that such hacking of the FBI and other agencies is essential to the viability of American democracy. And I don't know how to do this sort of hacking. I don't know at all. I'm an historian, not a technologist. Fortunately, however, this is perhaps among the best rooms on the planet to be having this discussion. Not including the FBI agents here to spy on us, and the NSA agents here to recruit you to spy for them, those in this room possess the incredibly rare combination of ninja technical skills and radical liberation politics to make such an endeavor possible. It's not surprising those in power wish to keep their actions secret. What's surprising is how readily we tolerate it. I'll say it again. The records of government are the property of the people. Reclaim them. Hack the FBI. Thank you.
Can you provide any specific details about how you expanded your search methodology to fill in or map the gaps? Did you just shotgun names or do anything more refined?
Are you asking about how I figured out the gaps or what the gaps themselves actually are?
Like how you chose your search terms, basically, to figure out where the gaps were. Or what?
Sure, absolutely. So, I mean, there are an unknowably large number of things that the FBI does to avoid compliance, so this is only going to speak to some of them. And the FBI is changing it all the time once people figure out what's going on. But sure, and what I'm talking about now, again, is about how to understand FBI non-compliance with the Freedom of Information Act and how I went about figuring out that what that was. So, well, for example, let's start with this. When one gets a letter from the FBI, like that letter that I showed you earlier that said, oh, we don't have any records on you, oops, no. And I should mention that I already have some hundreds of pages on me now that I've won from them in the lawsuit. They've been trying to get me on some sort of terrorism charges or another since the mid-90s, and they won't give me a few thousand more of my pages because national security, and that was a few years ago, so who knows how many there are now. But either way, when they send you a letter that says they don't have anything, and most people read it as saying they don't have anything, that's not actually what it says. What it says is we conducted a search of our central record system and were unable to identify main file records responsive to your request. And what that's actually saying is we conducted a search of one database using one search methodology for one file type and didn't find anything. And oops, by the way, we're not going to mention that that's absolutely not the search methodology, not primarily the file type that's likely to produce the requested records, and only one of many databases. And so a lot of what I was doing was simply trying to figure out, it's not a question of using the right terms, right? The problem isn't that you're not using the right terms. The FBI will try and say that at some times, but it's just completely untrue. The FBI essentially has two information storage and retrieval systems, one for FOIA, one for us, and one for them. And they're very capable of finding the things that they want to find. It's not an issue of them of not using the right terms. But because of the way that the FBI has designed their FOIA-specific information storage and retrieval systems, and by the way, that design is designed to fail. It is failure by design, right? How one crafts a search is very important, at least in theory. So I would recommend, if submitting FOIA requests, let's say there's a particular individual on whom you want records, and that individual is related to an activist group, and that activist group has a newsletter, and that activist group has been involved in particular actions, and those actions are against particular targets. Submit requests on all those things, all the things. Request all the things, right? And certainly one needs to, I mean, the problem is, so most people's FOIA requests are a page in length. Mine are usually about 30 pages long to the FBI, right? Search this database like this. Search this database like this. Use this search methodology. Search for this file type like this. However, again, the problem isn't that you're not doing it right. One really should be able to submit a one-page FOIA request and get what you're looking for. The problem is that the FBI is operating in straightforward bad faith. And so you can word your request however you want. You can request things however you want, and occasionally you might get a hit. But the bottom line is that FOIA requests for the FBI really shouldn't be written for the FBI. This isn't the case at all agencies, but with the FBI, successful FOIA work almost invariably requires litigation because the FBI simply is not going to do their job. They're not going to comply with the law. There's no teeth to the law, and they don't want to comply, so why should they? The worst case scenario for them is that you sue, in which case, you know, they don't lose anything other than what they would have given you in the, you know, what they would have just given you without the suit. So, unfortunately, successful FOIA work with the FBI frequently requires litigation. So FOIA requests to the FBI ultimately should be written for the judge. There's lots of ways to craft a request such that you have more to work with when you're before a judge, saying the FBI should have done this, this, and this because they had this information. But unfortunately, that there are no penalties for non-compliance means the FBI can basically thumb their nose at requesters until one sues. Other questions? Yeah.
Check. Hey. Hi there. Ryan, loved your work for a long time. Thanks for the talk. I've been looking forward to it for a long time. If you haven't been to Ronald's, they have awesome vegan donuts. That's all I had to say.
Cheers. Awesome, man. Thank you. I look forward to that. Appreciate it. I'll come to you next.
Ryan, hey. So you're a pretty smart guy. I understand the issue about Pandora's box, about the warning. My question is, in regards to hacking and reverse engineering, there's a lot of smart people in this industry who I've been able to be made aware of for 5 years, to clarify that even the information that you're requesting, you don't even know if it's the right information that you're going to receive. Thus, the ability for them to alter, change, or modify the information that you're requesting to get. So how do you go through that process of knowing that which what you're receiving or that what you may would hope to get is not even the information to know whether or not it's real or correct?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, as you're pointing out, they hold most of the cards. They hold all the documents. They're the people who search for the documents. Ideally, if you get it before a court, maybe you can get the documents before the judge, but you still have to get the FBI to bring the documents before the judge. I'm working with the tools that I have. How do I deal with it? As best that I can. You know, I sue them left and right. I stay on it. I submit hundreds and hundreds of requests. There's not a good answer other than the one that I'm advocating here. Hack the FBI. Let's find out. Right? And then we had a question from over here. What changes would I make to the Freedom of Information Act? Is that essentially the question? Sure. EFF is doing great work here. The National Security Archive is doing great work. There's a number of Epic does good work on this front. There's a number of excellent groups. I mean, and right now the revisions that are being proposed dealing with exemption B5, that's a key one. Clarifying the fee waiver language, this is critical. I mean, there are innumerable fixes that could be made, but the number one most important fix from my perspective would be penalties for non-compliance, that there should be some incentive for an agency to not completely flout federal law because they feel like it. Yeah. Any last questions? Or?
Sure. By your description, the Freedom of Information Act requests you're making are pretty specific. Do you make those available in an archive so that people can basically use your work?
Do I make the results or the requests themselves?
The requests, including the language of the requests.
I don't have that available in an archive, and it is constantly changing based on the FBI's changes and what I learn. But it's something that I am happy to discuss with someone with people on an individual level. Yeah.
Okay. Thanks.
And I think that's all the time that we have. Thank you so much for coming.